Yeah. Well, you know, if there's one wholesome thing that sort of came out of it, it's apparently that Jerry Trainer is like an
Yes.
amazing guy.
Yes.
You know, like interjecting and trying to take Schneider's attention away from his co-stars and actively trying to be on set even on his days off, to protect them and make sure that they were okay.
I haven't watched Quiet on Set just yet because even just like watching this stuff online has been a lot. But from what I understand, we know most of it because of like people mining back through clips and everything, but also because of Jeanette McCurdy's memoir, I'm Glad My Mom Died, which love that for her. Like, I love that she has, because I feel like she did get a lot of shit with people trying to like crap on her experiences because nobody can believe a victim, you know, especially when
Right.
it's to do with like parents. Like, people have a really, really hard time tolerating and believing those kinds of things. So it's just kind of like a giant fuck you to all of those people in
Yeah.
like the best way.
The internet had to wait until Drake Bell came out and started complaining about it, which, like, you know, is also horrible that those things happened to him. But I feel like her memoir came out like a while ago, didn't it?
I want to say 2022 was when she was doing like promo and everything for it.
Right. And I remember hearing a little bit about it back then, but I feel like it's kind of bubbling back up again because of the Drake Bell stuff.
I mean, it's hard to market a book where you're like titled the way it is and also without the support of the other people in the network who it happened to, because we know for a fact that there's been like a few people that have kind of spoken up about it in the past, but nobody where it's like really taken off. But obviously enough people spoke up individually that they put together this tell-all kind of thing.
Right.
So exciting
Well,
stuff in like
better
a
late than never, I suppose.
I just don't know how we didn't see it with the foot logo. I
Yeah,
mean, we were
that's
kids.
like,
We were kids, so that's not on us, but
right. Also, it's like, I know that's the joke everyone's making. Did Dan Schneider even design that logo? Like, or is it just a very weird coincidence?
coincidence or not, it doesn't sit well within the
Right.
context of everything else. It makes me wonder about like every single foot joke in my childhood.
Yeah. There's a lot of feet jokes in iCarly. I mean, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, I do. I loved that show.
Yeah. So fun stuff, I guess. Or not so fun, but
You know, fun in the love having my childhood ruined
yeah.
kind of way. Great way to start the podcast. Fun stuff.
Great way to start the
So introductions in order. This is my friend Michael. We met when I was living in Houston. He is in the same PhD program as Taylin. So Michael, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit more beyond that?
Yes, thank you, Melissa. I am a PhD student at Rice University, studying English literature, though, as many academics know, English literature has become a catch-all for various topics in the humanities since the 1980s, basically depending on whatever it is that you want to study, as long as you can argue that it has some kind of textual basis, like an archive. Which is all to say that even though I study English literature, my interest in the past few years and what I'm currently writing my dissertation on is games, actually, specifically role-playing games, both computer and tabletop. And specifically, I'm kind of trying to bring a literary critical perspective, and you know, somewhat of a critical theory philosophy perspective to contemporary video game studies, because video game studies is an academic discipline that has really kind of started taking off, I want to say, over the past 2 decades, kind of since 2001, though people were doing it a little bit earlier than that too. And I've consistently found that even though there are good discussions happening in video game studies spaces, there are so many useful things that could be kind of brought over from existing discussions that had already taken place in literary criticism that are kind of being left by the wayside. Whether it's techno fetishism or, a belief that video games are somehow altogether different in such a way where existing discourses would not apply to them in any way whatsoever. I just think that it is important work. Or at least that's what I tell myself because it makes writing the dissertation easier.
Yeah.
But I'm also a part-time dungeon master and/or game master and/or storyteller for various tabletop role-playing game groups. One of which, Melissa, is a player. Actually, a couple of which now,
Yeah.
Melissa is a player in.
Yeah, I got the bug, the bite, and now anytime you're starting a new campaign, I'm like, all right, tell me what I gotta do to set this up. Yeah, I mean, we had met a few times at like parties and stuff with Taylin, but it wasn't until you were like actively starting up, if anyone plays D&D, you're starting up a Light of Xerxes campaign and invited me to join. And I was like, yeah, this was like last summer. So almost a year ago now. And now I was part of the group that you used to write a paper for a conference recently when you did
Yes.
Changeling, which was really exciting. Highly recommend if you're into tabletop stuff and you haven't played Changeling yet. It's a lot of fun. Very complicated, very
Very
complicated.
complicated.
Yes, but a lot of fun.
One of the reasons that it is so complicated, and I have, hold on, I
Okay.
have my books here. Don't know if you can see that very well, but one of the reasons that Changeling the Dreaming is so complicated right now is because there has been kind of no updated version of it.
Okay.
I'll give a little bit of background here.
Yeah, go for it.
There is a line of role-playing games, a series of role-playing games called The World of Darkness. The World of Darkness was, I believe, started in about in 1996
Okay.
by White Wolf Publishing. Yeah.
Actually, real quick, before you dive too deep into that, I do want to kind of talk about what we're going to talk about here. So
Sure,
that
yeah, go
way,
for it.
because it's a bookish podcast, I want to be clear. Like, this isn't like some really weird tangent. So the paper that you wrote was talking about the like play for play's sake. And when I was reading through it, I was very struck by the fact that like there's similar arguments happening within the bookish community, particularly within like fantasy romance community, because our biggest kind of like conflict that we come into like in the internet we hit up a lot is the accusation that it's like just porn. And I would argue that, I mean, I guess I would argue two sides. It's like sometimes yes it is some just porn, but sometimes it is like an exploration of other like much more than just porn, because maybe the people making these accusations, one, are just reading just like Haunting Adeline, which is aggressive dark romance, but that is not the entire genre. And so I wanted to bring you onto the podcast so we can talk a little bit about the paper. But obviously we
Yeah.
need more of the context. So yeah, so dive into the context in World of Darkness, and then I want to hear about the arguments specifically that you're making in your paper.
Sure, yeah. I will say before diving into it that kind of like is it just porn versus like is there actually like something valuable behind it? I mean I do think right there is also a value to just porn, right? I mean like sometimes people
Yes.
need things to help them relax and or unwind or even just like find enjoyment in their lives. And that kind of forms one of the cruxes of kind of the argument that I make in my paper. So in 1996, when the World of Darkness first kind of kicked off, White Wolf basically made a original series of five games, each of which involved players taking the role of these like kind of mythical fantasy creatures and playing in a shared world in which, vampires and werewolves are real. The most popular of which, Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf the Apocalypse, Mage the Ascension, Reoblivion, and Changeling the Ring, which is, I believe, the least popular of the original five games. This is largely due to like people aren't as interested in the tone of the game. I mean, you can even just tell looking at the books that Vampire and Werewolf tend to be darker games that handle very like mature topics. Not to say that Changeling doesn't, but you know, you're playing as a creature who rips and tears and eats people.
Yeah.
Changeling the Dreaming, and there's a joke about this in the blurb section at the front of the book, is often or was often considered like the World of Darkness game for girls. Because the call and it had a
Hold
plethora
on.
of trolls, bonds, cons.
I lost you for a second, which that one might have been on me. I'm gonna hook up my Ethernet cord. Okay,
Are we
so
good?
really it just you left off right when you were saying like a game for girls. So
Yeah, so there was a stigma, I suppose, in the 90s that Changeling the Dreaming was the World of Darkness game that you played if you were a girl. Which is not to say that the other ones weren't popular with female audiences. I think Vampire actually quite was, but I guess the male gaming audience didn't wasn't as enticed by the idea of playing fairies, like living in the real world, as like girl gamers were. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it's a good game. And I think that Changeling makes some very interesting arguments about the value of play, which is kind of the point of my paper.
okay.
White Wolf, as a publisher, and you can tell that this kind of lingers into the current era. It's current, The World of Darkness is no longer published by White Wolf. I believe Paradox owns the rights to the intellectual property. And they've gone through a couple of different publishers, Onyx Path, recently Renegade, I think, right now. The writers for the World of Darkness consistently are interested in theorizing, I guess, like the role-playing game and also the message behind some of their games. It's very funny. You'll see like Derrida quotes in the Werewolf the Apocalypse book.
That sounds like the worst possible. Like, if I'm in the middle of play and somebody starts quoting Derrida, I'm like having flashbacks. Full on PTSD, non-flashbacks. Not even kidding.
Sure. It, you know, it's funny. I do think it strikes a very, it straddles the line between being a little bit pretentious and being very cool.
Okay.
One of the reasons why, and maybe this is a little bit tangential, but I know there was some concerns about the game being very popular, I think, with like white supremacists or like, you know, alt-right folks for a
Okay.
while during like the early 2010s and 2000s. And I think that the developers of the game really kind of wanted to distance themselves from that.
Totally fair. Okay.
So in fact, the opening to the newest edition of Vampire the Masquerade has a whole like 2-page section about how, despite the fact that the game involves you playing as a monster, it's not an excuse for you to be an evil person in real life. And it actually like quotes like Hannah Arendt and talks about fascism being stupid,
Nice.
basically. And
Nice.
there's an
Okay.
index in the back. There's further recommended anti-fascist reading in the back of the rule book, which is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. I think that's part of the reason that, like, because I've definitely, I mean, I was in theater in high school, so D&D has popped up throughout my life. D&D and other, like, tabletop role-playing games has kind of, like, popped up as, like, an offer in my life before, but from, you know, the kinds of people that nowadays I would probably describe as like incel-y. So I love that, like, the proactivity in terms of, like, or I guess like the acknowledgement of that in some sense, and like actively trying to change that about their fan base, 'cause
Right. If
yeah.
there's one thing that I think the last decade or so has taught us, it's that fascists don't care about subtext.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if it needs to be textual to the point where they're quoting Derrida in the rule books, you know what? By all means, I'm here for it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I think, okay, not to go again, not to further the tangent. I will
Sure.
always further the tangent though when it's like anti-fascist stuff. I was recently doing a rewatch of Avatar: The Last Airbender. And so naturally, like, my entire feed currently is like the live action, it's the old film or the old TV show, it's Legend of Korra, it's a bunch of stuff popping back up. And the number of times that people are trying to argue that like ATLA went woke, and I'm like, did we watch the same show? Like, this is like this little band of like we get the episode of the freedom fighters, right? With Jet and the kids all fighting the Fire Nation and the colonization and everything. But also technically, Aang and Katara and Sokka are doing that the entire show. They present Jet and the Freedom Fighters to kind of like foil what a bad version of that looks like. And so like I just can't imagine watching that show and then 10 years down the line being like, it's all woke now. It's like Katara was a feminist icon. Don't even get me started on Katara. Like, you're gonna
Yeah.
tell me it's woke now? He's a vegan. What's more woke than a bald vegan monk child?
Right. Yeah, I
So.
mean it's the same people that you see, driving trucks around, and they've got "Don't Tread on Me" flags, and
Yeah.
also blue thin blue line American flags, and then
Yes.
like, stickers of like the Empire from Star Wars, and it's like, I don't think you understood, very
That's,
Andor coded.
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't imagine, to further the tangent, I don't imagine that you're following the discourse surrounding X-Men 97 currently.
No, anything I get from X-Men is really just like theories on what direction Disney's going to take the universe.
Yeah. X-Men, this will be a bold claim. I'm gonna make it anyway. X-Men might be the quintessential like woke comic book like team. In terms of the fact that their entire narrative is that they're like, marginalized minority that gets hated by.
It's very racially
Yeah,
coded. Yeah,
extremely.
entirely. Yeah.
X-Men has been woke for its entire
Yes.
publication.
Yeah.
And somehow people are now crossing their fingers, and or some people are already complaining that X-Men 97 has gone woke. Because Morph, do you know the mutant Morph?
No.
Morph is literally a character who can just shapeshift their body.
That makes sense.
Morph is in the new show non-binary, which just makes sense for a character that has those abilities.
Yeah.
And people are complaining that it's woke because Morph used to be a guy. And now that Morph is non-binary, it's like, what the hell? Woke. Female character costume designs have been changed to be a little bit less like, gratuitously sex appeal,
Yeah.
and it's somehow woke. So it,
That
again,
one
right? Fascists
infuriates
don't
me.
care about subtext.
Yeah.
But anyway,
We could talk about that part for hours. Okay,
yeah.
so back to the matter at hand. So when we first started playing Changeling, it was with the intent of you writing this paper. So you, I'm guessing, already had some, or I guess, was this a matter of you were searching kind of for a topic? Or did you have an inkling already about the subject of Changeling and kind of how you're planning to read through this?
Yeah, I definitely had an idea in mind already. My interest in Changeling started because I was at a conference, an academic conference, in Portland, Oregon last October. And I networked there a lot and I made a couple of friends, one of whom encouraged me to submit an abstract to another conference that was actually a couple of weeks ago in Florida called ICFA. It's the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts. Wonderful conference, all speculative fiction, basically, which is a very cool environment. And the theme of the conference this year was whimsy. And whenever I hear whimsy, my brain immediately thinks fairies. I should do something fairy related because fairies are often, whimsical. Fairy stories are full of whimsy. And so my brain immediately remembered that there was a World of Darkness game based on fairies, and that was Changeling the Dreaming. So I went back to my hotel room that night, or the Airbnb, and I pulled up the conference website. I purchased a PDF of the game's rulebook online. I read a couple of pages and I typed up an abstract about how the game kind of used whimsy as a way of fighting the banality of like the modern existence, you know, like under late stage capitalism. You know, because I was relatively certain that the game had something to say about that, even after only a couple of pages into the rule book. I submitted the abstract, it got accepted. And at that point, I was like, okay, I have to learn this game and I have to play it now, or I have to run it for people. So that way I can actually, I guess, like verify the kind of argument that I'm trying to make. I need the firsthand experience. And so that's kind of where you guys came in, because I was like, hey, this counts as research. I need to do this for school.
We
So
didn't
we
get
need to play a
paid
game.
for it, but it did count as research.
Yeah. You were my unpaid intern.
I'll add it to my resume.
But the reason that I kind of went on the tangent about like the Derrida quotes and you know, fascism is because since the inception of the World of Darkness, I really do think that the writers have had an interest in theorizing both, I guess, like the historical medium of the tabletop role-playing game, but also kind of interestingly the political stakes of what is happening in their individual games. And Changeling is a little bit difficult to figure out on that front, because Changeling is not really interested in things like monstrosity or violence as direct political action, the same way werewolf is or vampire is. Changeling is a much more subtle game about a world that is in danger of slowly losing itself to the ever encroaching chill of banality. And I'll actually read something here because there's a very good description. I just dropped my books. Hold on one sec. All right, we're good. There's a very good description that the writers of the game provide toward the beginning that I think kind of sums up a little bit what my argument about the game is. And I'm going to read it here. The introduction begins with an epigraph from William Shakespeare from The Tempest, which I'm not going to read, but that's very cool. Everyone dreams. Everyone looks at the world and thinks about how it could be better. Whether you've watched the news and wish crooked cops weren't so untouchable, or wished you were riding a griffin into battle to save your one true love instead of grinding out some mindless drudgery at work, everyone imagines a better world. Changing the world starts with dreams, with imagining something better, something more. Imagining something that's not as miserable as what really exists, or imagining something amazing, almost entirely divorced from reality, gladdens the heart and makes the world a little better, even if only for a little while. The world tries to pound away at those dreams and replace them with boring, banal reality. Someone that dreams too big, as if there was such a thing, hears that they need to focus on what's real and not their fantasies. It's just as dangerous, though, to dream too little. The world isn't just a drab mire of darkness and misery. It has hope and love and all other things that the best dreams are made of. It's just a matter of finding it. And so my paper that I kind of presented, and I don't need to go too much into the theory. My paper kind of argues that this theorization of dreaming aligns well with a couple of play theories by theorists like the Dutch historian Johan Huizinga, and more recently a play theorist by the name of Miguel Sickert, who both in their own way kind of make the case for play as a thing that is always done for itself. Huizinga is known for kind of making this argument that play is autotelic is the word.
Can you
Play is
define
never
that real
done.
quick?
Huh? Yeah.
Okay, cool. Define
I'm
that
sorry,
real
what?
quick.
Oh,
Autotelic.
define that. Autotelic means done for itself, so not done for another purpose, like teleology, if that, you know that word. Autotelic, yeah, in the sense that it's done for itself. So play is never done for another reason in Huizinga's case. He said, you know, there's a lot of people that try and argue, for instance, that play is performed, for like biological purposes. You play because it, is like a mating ritual, or you play because it makes you more efficient at work or something like that. And Huizinga wants to say, actually, no, you play because you want to play. You play because it's fun. And that kind of the reason for play escapes all kind of rational or instrumental claims about why it is that you would pursue it.
I think there was one line in your essay where you really distinctly kind of separated it, because you said like there's the reason for play and then there's also like the effects of it. Because when you think about play, you can think about, like wolf pups learning how to fight by playing with each other. And it's like they're playing and they are, yes, they're learning how to like interact. You can get like kittens with single kitten syndrome because they never learned how to properly play. But the act of playing, like the urge to do it, I think is really where that like the autotelic notion comes in. It's not so much that like the baby, whatever, is urged to play because they know they need to learn these skills. They learn the skills just as like a byproduct of something that they wanted to do just for the cause of doing it.
Right. That's the crux of kind of Miguel Sickert's intervention into thinking about play, is that Huizinga prefers to theorize play as kind of its own sphere. It's kind of like hermetically sealed off by virtue of a magic circle from specific socio or historical contexts. Sickert kind of, although he defends the nature of play as autotelic, is much more interested in grounding play in contexts and kind of situating the political stakes of play. And so, yes, as far as like the effects of play are concerned, I think I might know where in my paper my face is going to light up, because I'm pulling up my paper.
A Word doc, and it's going to make your entire screen bright white. Yep.
I can, because I think I know the part that you're talking about. So Sickert, he's got this great quote that I'll just read. Play is a fundamental part of our moral well-being, of the healthy and mature and complete human life. Through play, we experience the world, we construct it and we destroy it, and we explore who we are and what we can say. Play frees us from moral conventions, but makes them still present, so we are aware of their weight, presence, and importance. We play precisely because we need occasional freedom and distance from our conventional understanding of the moral fabric of society. Play is important because we need to see the values and practice them and challenge them so they become more than mindless habits. That's the end of Sickert's quote, and here's something that I write. What does this account of play conjure up, if not the dreaming that Changeling's rulebook provides in its introduction? The ability to distance one's self from the world as it exists so that we might imagine it differently and for the better. The suggestion here that play is important is not just some selfish, hedonistic suggestion that we ought to retreat into infantile activities as a way of not getting depressed by gas prices and genocide, but is actually trying to get us to see how useful it can be to alienate ourselves in the ways required for play. Again, this is not the purpose of play, which is autotelic, but it is absolutely a function of play, and this is not lost on the developers of Changeling, who openly suggested that this is what the game can offer. And
there's
so, yeah,
sorry, it's just like it's so full, like I've got a lot of points running around my head. There's a couple that I want to bring up really quickly.
Sure.
First of all, is that like, so when I was doing my master's, I took a class on rituals, and I can't remember the exact title of the class, but one of the rituals that we talked about was well, there's a couple that we talked about that kind of specifically relate to this as well. One is like Carnival, and then the other one is like a Shivery, which I think is called something different throughout like different regions of the world. But like in Southern United States, we call it a Shivery. And it's like ritualistic acts of release, like the necessity of release. Because human nature requires that when we've been stuck into like Okay, I'm gonna bring in like the religious trauma aspect of this, but like when we've been stuck into like a puritanical society, when we've been stuck into a society where like they created cornflakes to try to make us masturbate less, there has to be a release somewhere else. And I don't just mean like a literal like sexual release, because again, like I'm coming at this from the side of like the accusation that, like, quote unquote accusation that fantasy romance and romance novels are just porn for women. Fun fact, porn for women is just normal porn. Like, if we wanted porn, we would just watch porn. The difference with the book is that, like, you get this expectation of release. You get to go through, it's like, yeah, all romance books are a little bit formulaic, but you go into it knowing that. It's the same reason that some people like read crime dramas. You, if you read enough crime dramas, you know the structure, you know the patterns.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say briefly too, what you're describing is also just genre, you know, like
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
you go into science
100%.
fiction expecting aliens and laser guns, you
And
know.
you can safely expect like a similar plot line to Dune or to Star Wars. Like, they are going to follow similar structures. And so it's like that, like that expectation of catharsis at the end. That's why you go to certain genres for a specific type of catharsis. And so it's play, I feel like, falls into that similar kind of, like, you go in expecting a specific kind of catharsis. Granted, depending on the game you're playing, like, I wouldn't go into Vampire the Masquerade and expect a happy ending. But again, genres. assuming you guys are still doing that game, I won't say anything further.
It's on. We've been taking a break recently, but we intend to keep playing at some point. I've been
Yeah,
busy writing my dissertation, so.
exactly. You guys are doing PhD stuff. Another thing that I was thinking about is, like, I guess is like a sub thing to that as well, is what makes people choose certain ways to escape. And I don't just mean like a game versus a book, but like if we're looking at books again specifically, or looking at like the different kind of like genres that World of Darkness has created, what makes somebody, for instance, myself, more attracted to like fantasy and urban fantasy and often like high fantasy, whereas other people are seeking out very kind of like tame romance. And I think it's because of like what feels safe to play in. Because I think at the end of the day, that's a lot of why you engage with like fantasy in these new ways, because it's like a safe environment for you to explore new things. Another recurring joke, which I'm sure does not help the porn accusations, is like reading a book and then suddenly discovering a new kink. And you're like, well, I did not know that that was something I was into, but here we are. So, like, again, like engaging in safe fantasy in order to, like, I guess in like a very cliche sense, like discover new things about yourself. But I see also similar conversations happening in like D&D.
Right. Yeah, I mean, per that quote that I just read by Sickert, right? He literally argues, I mean, play is a way for you to discover things about yourself. It's not as if the, you know, the light porn fantasy book or whatever is giving you new kinks. It's that you, there was something about you that may have been interested in that already. You didn't have a concept of it. And so you're learning something about yourself by exploring this safe kind of imaginary place. I mean, you're dreaming is what it is, right? You're imagining, you're alienating yourself from your contemporary lived experience so that you can ma imagine alternate possibilities. And through these alternate possibilities, you're able to kind of bring things into reality that were maybe already there, you just didn't realize it. And so there's both kind of the individual stakes here, which is that play is useful, and this is per my paper, I give a little bit of a breakdown of the way in which Changeling the Dreaming handles this thing called banality as like a kind of mechanic. I'll give a very brief explanation. Everything in Changeling the Dreaming, from people to locations to items to buildings, has a banality rating. Most fairy players start at a banality rating of 3. And if your banality goes to 10, basically you are basically just a mundane thing that has been completely cut off from the dreaming. If you're a fairy, for instance, if you're a changeling and your banality goes to 10, you are undone and your fairy self is basically destroyed for the rest of your life and you're condemned to life as a mortal. You lose all of your memories of your past self and who you are and that kind of stuff. And
Great.
there's a way in which mechanically Changeling wants to imagine that becoming undone as a fairy is actually the worst possible fate, or one of the worst possible fates you can imagine. The fiction of the game actually has, as part of its doomsday prophecy, an era called the Long Winter, which is a prophesied moment in history where dreaming completely dies and the human world is completely shut off irrevocably from the dreaming in the fairy world of Arcadia. And so Changeling, both mechanically and fictionally, wants to frame the loss of the ability to dream as one of the worst possible things imaginable. And so it kind of helps give a fantastical fictional framework that makes it easier for us to imagine that. But I think alongside work like Sickert, who is much more interested in arguing tangibly what the benefits are of play for a moral human society, it's actually very easy to kind of see how the game maybe wants you to carry this argument over into real life. I mean, you should play because it'll help you decrease your banality rating. I mean, in real life, right? You go home and you've had a bad day at work, and maybe, it's okay to just, I don't know, boot up Skyrim for a little bit and play for a couple of hours because you had a bad day at work and you need something to make you happy, which is why, which is why it's okay also for people to be interested in just porn. Like, I'm not saying the books are, but it's also, it shouldn't be a thing that is also seen as bad, I guess, if people really need to unwind. But
That, I mean,
on top
I
of,
will put the addendum of like, the porn industry is exploitative, but then
sure, yeah, of course.
like the act of like engaging in something that purely for like sexual reasons is valid. And I think a conversation bigger than the conversation we're having now, which is like feminine sexuality, like women's ex like connection to sexuality being demonized as well.
Right.
Because men don't make that accusation about other men. So, yeah. So, I mean, I want to make that addendum so that, like, it is
Sure.
something that's we're considering, but much larger conversation.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair. But yeah, beyond the individual stakes, right? There's also the moral and political stakes, which is that, again, per Sickert's argument, and a lot of people make this argument about speculative fiction in general. This is one of the easiest ways to justify working in speculative fiction if you're an academic, is to say that fantasy and science fiction, similar to what the book argues dreaming does, allows you to alienate yourself from the status quo of reality so that you can kind of look back from an outsider's perspective and critique your world from a speculative, removed position. You can play and you can read a fantasy novel and you can read a science fiction novel and you can play D&D and you can interact with the world or with imagined worlds in a kind of, as you were saying earlier, a very safe, low stakes, almost like laboratory situation that allows you to theorize and think through ideas or concerns that you have about the real world.
I will
Now,
say, and I don't want to bring up the J word or like the H word, but I will, like with J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. And I think the irony of it is that it's almost against her will, because like I will clarify, I'm like anti J.K. Rowling at this point, which is very
Same.
frustrating for me as somebody who was like raised with Harry Potter. But I see these movies again regularly because they're on TV endlessly. And I work from home. So, you know, recipe for disaster. But like for her to be the way that she is and to have created like fiction that in even in my experience was so formative in terms of like my kind of anti-fascist notions is, I think in some ways it's confusing, but it's also like there's because it became a safe way. It's like it was a very obvious allegory for the Holocaust and for you know, like Hitler, and it's all very surface level, but that's, I mean, it's kids' literature, so of course it's going to be not that deep. But it was a way for me as a kid to engage in that kind of very dark storytelling. And then when I was rewatching Avatar again, you know, like the thing that only recently apparently got woke, I was watching it with my mom. And my mom, for almost my entire life, after I was like a preteen, she's like, I'm not watching cartoons with you anymore. She was one of those. So I have done this thing where when we're like eating together, I'll just put on one of my shows. And then eventually she's watching the show with me because she gets hooked. And so that's how I got her to start watching this. And I mean, Avatar: The Last Airbender nails every single season, every single finale is chef's kiss, perfect, succinct. We're watching the show and she's like crying sometimes and she's like, I thought this was a kid's show. And it's like, it is. And that's exactly why these kinds of subjects are coming up, because you have to give kids like a safe space to engage with this kind of stuff. Otherwise, you go into the real world, it's not like Peppa Pig. Like, we're beyond that. So I just feel like, because I feel like we're talking about heavy things. And so I wanted to kind of also tie in the fact that like it's kids stuff as well, where like when you're engaging in fantasy, it's a reflection of something very clearly in the world that created it. Because it doesn't exist within a vacuum, it exists within like a context of, you know, eco-terrorism and fascism. And, you know, you get Legend of Korra where pretty much all of the villains are like some form of fascism, some like subset of fascism. It's very obviously making those commentaries. And I hate to say it, but it's a lot of fun to engage in that as well, because they've actually defeat the bad guys in the shows. You know, Harry defeats Voldemort.
That's a useful kind of catharsis to have media that allows us to imagine ourselves winning. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of I don't remember who it is. Maybe it was Gramsci. What is it? Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. The idea that you need to kind of resist, at least pragmatically, defeatist sentiments about any kind of political struggle that you might be engaging in, because nothing will kill morale faster than convincing yourself that your fight is futile. If you go into a struggle, a political struggle, a moral struggle, an ethical struggle, believing from the beginning that you are going to fail and that you're just doing it because, I don't know, out of a sense of duty or something like that, to see it through, even though you're going to fail, it's very difficult. You know, I don't want to make this sound like some kind of, like, you know, the manifestation, like The Secret, you know, like you imagine your reality kind of stuff, but it really is important actually to genuinely believe, even if you have to dogmatically believe, that there is a way that you can win. That's a very important element that is vital for any kind of political struggle. And, you know, that's one of the problems that we see too with, like, the black pilling era of the internet, where it's like, you know, oh, climate change is, you know, fucked already. Like, we can't do anything about it, we're screwed. It's like, actually, is that really like a helpful view? I mean, even if you're right, is that a helpful view? Like
Yeah.
perhaps we should instead really try and believe. And here's the pessimism of the intellect part. Don't assume that you are smart enough to know for certain that you're going to lose.
Yes. I think in both sides, like what you just said, and then also like the, well, there's nothing that I can do. It's very much a matter of ego. It's thinking like, well, if what I'm doing doesn't tip the scales, then it's pointless. And I think that is such like a such a political like fallback. And I think that's a critique generally of liberalism at this point, where like if it's not 100%, then it's a no. And it's like that, but that doesn't actually work anywhere in any context at any point in time. But it does remind me of Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, when Aragorn, when they're all basically just trying to be a distraction so that Frodo can get his Frodo and Sam can get the ring up, and they're like, let's just give Sauron what he wants. Let's give him the prince or the king. And when they think that Frodo's dead, the whole purpose of them going over there technically is done, but Aragorn is like, fuck that. And he turns around and he still fights, because at the end of the day, they're there and they actually have the opportunity at that point to fight the rest of Sauron's forces. And so they try to do it. And then it works out, because instead of just being like, well, it's all over, we can't win anyway, we've lost to the most powerful evil within our time, they trust their gut, and Frodo, does he? No, we know that. They don't know that.
Right.
The ring still ends up in the fire, I should say.
I think that's one of the benefits of that's a great example, by the way. I think that one of the benefits of fantasy and of speculative fiction is that these genres often defy rationality in the sense of, you just kind of accept that there are crazy things that exist in these worlds. And so there's a presumption kind of from the onset that these worlds have surprises, that they can still surprise you in ways that we often feel the real world cannot surprise us anymore. And maybe this is just kind of like a result of enlightenment thinking and like a very kind of like deterministic view or model of the universe. But we need to continue to believe that the world is weirder than we can account for, and that the possibility still exists for miracles, right? And I'm not saying miracles in any necessarily kind of supernatural sense, but miracles in the sense of like some new development can happen. Not saying new technology. I'm not saying I endorse like a techno fix, like Elon Musk is going to save us from climate change or something like that. But we need to be open to the possibility that something about the situation will change unexpectedly and for the better in such a way that actually gives us the ability to win. Like you said, right, if Aragorn just kind of took it at face value, right, when the Mouth of Sauron hands him the mithril shirt and says that Frodo is dead, Aragorn holds out hope that a miracle is still possible, right? Perhaps the Mouth of Sauron is lying to me. Perhaps Frodo is still alive. Perhaps there is a reason for me to stay and fight. And just based on that chance alone, I'm going to, I'm projecting here. I'm assuming perhaps what it is that Aragorn is thinking, but
I mean, there's the very logical thing, which is that if they had Frodo, if Sauron had the ring, they wouldn't be talking to the Mouth of Sauron. They would be talking to like a fully regenerated, I assume, Sauron.
sure.
But also, like, even if they didn't have proof of Sauron's like return, they also didn't have solid proof of Frodo's death.
There is an example that I want to give here that's one of my favorite video games that I've ever played. And I want to write about this in my dissertation at some point, but it's an isometric RPG by the name of Disco Elysium.
Okay, real quick.
Yeah.
Isometric RPG, define
Yeah.
that.
Isometric, so RPG role-playing game. Isometric refers to the kind of perspective So top down, like at an angle, if you've ever played Diablo or Baldur's
Okay.
Gate. Baldur's Gate is an isometric RPG.
Okay.
So if
Where
you've
you're
seen
kind of like
gameplay of
in the
Baldur's Gate.
camera view watching your little people.
Right.
Yeah.
Top down, you click to move your character around, not like Skyrim, where you're in first person or third person over the shoulder.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Disco Elysium is kind of a weird, I don't even feel comfortable calling it fantasy or science fiction. It's an alternate world, kind of post-collapse capitalist hellscape. You're playing as a detective who has amnesia, who's trying to solve a murder mystery, while the game also has you tasks you with trying to figure out who you are. It's very existential, because you have amnesia because you got drunk after like a 3-day drinking binge.
Love that.
The entire game is extremely pessimistic and critical of pretty much any political perspective. You can choose at many different points throughout the game, for instance, to internalize different political viewpoints. You could be a fascist, a radical feminist, a Marxist. There's like the game pokes fun at all of these different perspectives. Though I will say that based on how the game is written, the developers do seem to have a left-leaning perspective, which is cool. But the game, one of the many things that the game kind of features as a side quest is you can help a bunch of cryptozoologists track down a creature called the Insulindian phasmid that they've been searching for their entire lives. And because of the way the game conditions you, you expect that this is kind of going to turn out to be like a nothing burger. The entire game is just full of very disappointing stories where people end up being worse than you expect them to. Disappointing things happen. And you kind of just get overwhelmingly the sense that the world sucks and nothing's going to change. But during the game's climax, inexplicably, if you have completed this side quest that sees you actually receiving a bottle of pheromones from the cryptozoologists to track down the Insulindian phasmid, the cryptid actually shows up in the very final moments of the game and has a telepathic conversation with you, about how there is still time for you to fix your life.
Oh, that's sweet.
And it's literally one of the best moments in video games that I've ever played. I mean, just beautiful moment. And I've talked with friends about this before, where I always theorize that moment as the game's developers saying, "Yes, I know for 99% of the game we have been nothing but cynical, assholes, and told you that everything that you believe is stupid and that you should give up on your dreams." But the game kind of rejects that narrative at the very end and says, like, "Oh, actually, the world is still weirder and more miraculous than you can possibly imagine. So don't presume that you understand how everything is going to end up." And I think fantasy and science fiction do a great job at that, because fantasy and science fiction can often suspend rationality for a second. Fantasy and science fiction can say, imagine, that there's a world where this miraculous technology fixes climate change. Imagine that there's a world in which we can use magic to, I don't know, feed people or overthrow fascist dictators. And that kind of just goes back to the whole thing of like, well, what is the value of dreaming? What is the value of playing? What is the value of fantasizing? So that, I mean, that all goes back to kind of this entire argument that is, it's actually tremendously valuable for us to not lose our ability to dream, fantasize, play, what have you, because these things are all fundamental to our ability to alienate ourselves in a politically useful way, in sort of, I don't know, like Marxist kind of, I don't know,
On this podcast?
maybe Heideggerian, I don't know.
Flashbacks. It is kind of specifically going back to your game. And I guess this does kind of tie back into, because I want to talk specifically about like the stereotype of the fae in relation to all of this, because that's like a big fae are like a big thing in Bookstagram, book talk, whatever. But there's this kind of like the two sides of nihilism, which is like the one side, which is like internet douchebags who don't like really understand what they're talking about and are like, nothing matters, so nothing matters. Versus the other side, which is that like kind of everything is meaningless, so you can make your own meaning. And I think going back to like your cryptid, whose name I cannot remember,
The Insel
giving
Indian Phasmid.
that one, Insulinian. Nope, I think I already got it wrong. But like giving this conversation, or like giving this like telepathic message at the end, which is like, things can still be weird. And that's kind of the point, which is just like, it doesn't mean that life's not worth living. 'Cause I think that's the spiral that you can go down when you're engaging with this kind of like political commentary, when you've got like, in Star Wars, they're always making like a bigger Death Star. They're always making like a new version of the clones, a new version of Darth Vader. It's grandson now, and it's like, cycles, repeats, and it's like, okay, but then also they're always birthing new resistance. And it's kind of like that point, if we're talking about this in terms of like engaging with like political stuff. But tying this into Faye, I think Faye is on the one hand, I'm very frustrated by the fact that people are just gonna like, oh, this is the version of World of Darkness for women because of the colors and because of, whatever. But I think Faye as like, okay, first of all, you should read Cruel Prince. I've got it right there. We live in different states, so I can't let you borrow it. But it
Okay.
is very traditional Fae. Like, you don't give your name kind of Fae because they'll use it against you. Versus, like, this one right here is the one that everybody knows. It's ACOTAR, Court of Thorns and Roses. They're Fae pretty much only in the fact that they've got, like, loosely season-based powers and pointy ears, and some of them can fly. Fae in the loosest possible sense. But I think the appeal of Fae is similar to like the appeal of demons, where like there's this very clear cultural or social structure that they have to follow, which I think everybody experiences. You go to school and you have to follow certain rules when you're first learning, you get fairy stories and everything, or you go to work and you have to follow certain rules. But the point of fairy is to subvert the rules and not to break the rules. Because that's always the rule, or I guess the rule with them is that like they can't lie. They can't technically break laws, but they will find a way around it. And so it's engaging with like societal norms in order to like, dumping water into a bucket to find the holes.
Right.
Yeah. So I think in that sense, like, I think that's where a lot of the appeal of fairy comes from. Because if we're looking at like World of Darkness, and we're looking at each of these different creatures, like the vampires, werewolves, they've all got pulling, I guess, not just in World of Darkness, but like the ones that World of Darkness chose are very popular as well in Book Talk, in Bookstagram, in bookish spaces. And I think because they're all making like a different comment on something, the same reason they exist, which is like, vampires are typically aristocratic, and they're kind of gluttons. They're this kind of like metaphor or allegory or whatever you want to call it for people who can't say no to their addictions. And so it's like, how do you explore that within then, a book or a game? And so I really, more and more, I'm fond of like Cruel Prince version of Fae, where it's not just like, you know, sexy pointed ears, but like, how are we actually engaging with the society around us? And it's frustrating because you get villains in the story who technically aren't breaking any rules. And it's like, how do you contend with that as a reader who's reading in the first person, you know?
Yeah, I mean, again, right, going back to that Sickert quote, one of the reasons we play is so that we can suspend moral conventions, but so that we can engage with them, and so that we can reflect on them, and so that we can ultimately not reject them wholesale, but kind of decide what it is that we're doing with them. I mean, sorry to name drop again, right? But it's like, what's at stake here? Is a Nietzschean transvaluation of values, right? It is not a rejection of all rules. It's not a rejection of all moral conventions. Rather, it is a critical engagement with values and with moral conventions and with rules. So that way we can kind of ultimately reflect on what the purpose of those values is. Why do we continue to observe certain rules? Why do we continue to uphold certain moral conventions? Are these, outdated holdovers of a system that is no longer relevant and thus doing more harm than good? Or is there a le legitimate reason why, we treat other people with kindness or respect? And I think that something that this opens the door for also, and this is another element of the discussion that I don't really get to in my paper, but Sickert acknowledges that there's a dark side to play as well. And Changeling, I actually think, argues that there's a dark side to play as well. Because on the one hand, right, and you kind of maybe got a little bit at this earlier when you were kind of talking about different perspectives on, I guess, nihilistic behavior. On the one hand, you have banality, right? You have the sort of depressing black-pilled, things are only going to get worse. The world sucks. This is just how it is. You have to accept the reality of the world, and so on and so forth. But there is a dark side to play as well, because play is often the means by which conspiracy theory and like cults operate. QAnon is operating by virtue of a large-scale augmented reality role-playing game that they've created for themselves. And basically, what you have when you kind of have these very ironic, like alt-right fascists who really just like they're just doing it for the memes, right? They vote for Donald Trump and they support him because it's funny and because they think it's funny to just not care about anything because the world is meaningless. What you open the door to is a very kind of toxic, I can do whatever I want because nothing is real, and all of these values are fake anyway, so I can hurt whoever I want and I can mess up the world however I want because none of this matters. Changeling, the other side of banality, is bedlam, which is what happens when a fae is completely lost to madness. If you spend too much time in the dreaming, or if you begin to rely too much on your chimerical self, such that you start to accrue too much nightmare dice, rather than being lost to banality, you can be lost to bedlam. You go completely insane, you lose your mind, and you completely lose your ability to interact meaningfully with the human world, because you just kind of go insane in a way that renders you outside of all mortal social conventions.
I was gonna say, like, if we're talking about QAnon and we're talking about this like conspiracy theory side of it, I would argue that there's like a thin line, like granted, but like this line kind of between people role playing for the shit of it and like the kind of psychosis of thinking that like, you know, like the lizard people, the kind of like, I can't even like, because the lizard people conspiracy is very rooted in like anti-Semitism, And it's like they can't recognize that because, as far as they're concerned, they think it's literal lizard people. They
Or
don't
they've
recognize.
convinced themselves that it's literal lizard people,
Yeah.
but part of them started out thinking that because they thought it was funny.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like that where that crossover happens is kind of like, and I think this is a darker side to fantasy in general, which is, I don't want to be like, the internet diagnosed me, but like I've been getting a lot of reels lately about like maladaptive daydreaming, which I recognize that I do. I did it a lot as a child, and it was very much like, because as a kid, I wasn't being properly like challenged. I could daydream through an entire class, and I'm talking like straight through high school. I could daydream through an entire class and still be fine and like get things done on time. I would make sure to like, I think I just picked up on the cues when I need to like pay attention, right? And so like I definitely got to the point where like I was daydreaming almost consistently throughout the day. But I recognized it as like, I'm daydreaming. I'm just like imagining shit. It's maladaptive in the fact that like it got to the point where I had to do it out of like compulsion almost. But not everybody who engages in maladaptive daydreaming can see that. And not everybody who engages in maladaptive daydreaming can recognize the difference between like their daydreams and realities. And I think that's where like I can also, I don't want to say see the other side of this. I don't want to give value to people arguing like against fiction, or like I guess fiction in like a very like superficial sense, but like specifically fantasy, specifically sci-fi, because like we've talked about during this is like engaging in these other stories, kind of like engaging in these other ways that life can play out is essential to lived experience. And it's all like it's essential to growing empathy. It's essential to like, if we're talking about like your game where you're able to choose kind of like your political alignment, or Baldur's Gate, where you can choose to do like a Dark Urge run. If you consistently cut yourself off to even the like possibility of conceptualizing another side, then you don't give yourself the opportunity to like actively choose what you believe. But if you're so like dead set on trying to see all sides, then you can't. And I think like also like see all possibilities. If you can't choose, then you're gonna go around thinking that like life is an augmented reality and you can just post Trump memes and none of it matters. Like there's like the decisiveness that has to come as well for it to, I think, like not have the potential negative effects.
I mean, a lot of that comes as a result of forgetting that at the end of the day, you do kind of occupy a very specific subject position, historically, socially, culturally, and that you can, in truth, never fully argue from like a nowhere position. Like a lot of the people who end up nihilistically convincing themselves that nothing matters, argue from a position that is really kind of just like a weird kind of materialist determinism that imagines that, superlatively, the real universe is actually the universe without human perspectives, and that without human perspectives, nothing can be said to matter. Because mattering or meaning or values are things that are subjective because they're created by human intention. And so somehow they've convinced themselves that human values are never truly real because they're, I don't know, like made up or fake, which is it presumes a whole weird kind of like metaphysics of what is real versus what is not, versus the more grounded critical theory perspective of, well, if something is made, then it's real. It's like you wouldn't say that a building isn't real because we had to build it, like.
It does kind of remind me of like the, because it's this kind of like very saturated version of like the myth of individualism that like capitalism can breed. This is going way off tangent. But I don't have the power to stop myself.
That's fine.
And actually maybe like when we're talking about D&D, when we're talking about like the bookish community and like the kinds of little sub communities that these can create, actively fights that individual notion, like the idea that you exist and nobody else does. It's funny, so I'm also like loosely within like the spiritual community, and a big buzzword there, and I'm gonna like caveat that as saying buzzword because I don't think everybody always uses it properly, but like collective, the collective. But it's this kind of like the idea that we're all separate is actually kind of like a myth. And that's not to say that like we're all actually one hive mind within the universe, but that is to say that like your place within your community, whether you see it or not, directly affects the people within that community. And I think D&D is a really fun way to kind of like very literally engage with that. And Changeling as well. I think that's part of the reason that I wanted to talk about Changeling on here, because like if we're talking about play, Changeling does it in a very kind of like meta way. It's not just that like, because we're talking about the banality. So like within the game, you fight banality by having fun, but you have to have fun like within the game. And so it's like, okay, how do I, as the player, make sure that my character is having fun? And that in and of itself makes me and the players that we're playing with have fun. Because there was like the spell that I had to do, or my character had to do. And you were explaining, like, well, if you wanted to add more power to it, you could like have her burp, have her do something weird and whimsical beforehand. And that's like a fun metric to have within the game. Because then we get to surprise everybody at the table with what we decide that we want to do. And so I think there is that kind of like, if you think you're the only one in the universe who's actually sentient, like there's like the there's that version where it's like actually everybody else isn't real, it's a simulation.
Solipsism.
Don't even get me started. Because it's so egotistical, it's so based in like main character syndrome. It's so frustrating to think that like you are the only person who exists. But then it wipes people of any like, community responsibility. And I think it's that community connection within fiction, within like bookish communities and D&D that really like fight that. And I won't say they're perfect by no means, because like there's drama in both communities all the time. But also that just comes with the territory. So.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I mean, there is that element of Changeling, right? And I do talk about this in my paper, where the game has curiously been designed in such a way that by pursuing whimsy as a goal, diegetically, as it were, in the game, you also kind of ensure the completion of that goal extra diegetically, which is to say, if fighting banality in game is the purpose of your particular chronicle, doing so in game actually has the unintended side effect of doing so outside the game as well, because presumably the players have a good time and enjoy themselves, and their lives are improved by virtue of having enjoyed themselves. So there is that very interesting quality that Changeling has that I haven't really kind of seen in any other game, at least not so explicit as Changeling tries to make it. But yes, I do think, right? So like not to get too philosophical, right? But solipsism as a view largely comes as a result of kind of like, I guess, this misguided Cartesianism, like, mind body duality, a sort of problem where
Yeah.
you kind of begin from the presumption that you exist and you have a mind because you have direct access to your own phenomenological experience, and that you can never be entirely sure that other people have minds because you do not have direct access to their own phenomenological experience, their own conscious experience of the world. Not to out myself as a Heideggerian, I suppose, but the theory that Heidegger kind of suggests is a Mitsein or Mitdasein, the idea of being with, which is a function of being in the world for Heidegger, which I'm not even going to try and explain. But Heidegger has this very interesting idea that kind of you intuitively understand yourself to be in a community, to be in a shared world that is inhabited by other people with real perspectives just as your own. That is something that you kind of just understand to begin with. And in fact, the mistake of Cartesianism is to imagine that you can remove yourself in such a way that then allows you to theoretically reflect on your own isolation after the fact. I'm not necessarily, saying or trying to convince anybody of this particular reading, but I do think that there is some interesting relevance, with D&D in particular, because especially when you're playing at a table with other people, the experience of D&D is fundamentally collaborative. I mean, even if it's
Yeah.
just one player and a DM, you have to share the story. Neither one of you can actually be the perfect arbiter of what happens in the story versus what doesn't. And so there is something very interesting about communal aspects and collaborative aspects with regard to games and storytelling.
I think, like, obviously, with books, that kind of collaborative notion functions very differently because we as readers don't have any say in the way that the book plays out, right? But there is the community of readers. So I think within like bookish stuff, it's not so much that like we are in like literal or like metaphorical conversation with the author, but we as readers, as like a function, are in conversation with the text itself. And I think that's where you get that community element. And I think part of where you can see the like reader-writer overlap is when you get things that people love to deem like fan service. Where like there'll be throwaway lines, and I know for a fact that I've talked about it on the podcast. I cannot remember what book it was, but like on the like in the age of the internet, obviously it's going to be a bit more big. But like, actually, I think it might have been an Armin Trout book. Who I realize you probably don't know, Jennifer L. Armin Trout did or is currently in the process of doing the Blood and Ash series, and people like to nickname her characters, like everybody else, like all the other authors, their stuff gets nicknamed or like fan, like headcanons and stuff for like nicknames. And then I remember she threw one into a book after, like in the sequel, after the fans had put, like had given this character a nickname and she put it in the book. And that's fun to read as a reader because then you know that you're being, like it feels like a connection is what it is. Like she's, it's not just like us yelling into a void, but the void answers back. And I guess because there's not the like active participation in the creation of the story so much. But then you've got the other side where, again, I'll bring up the H word, which is like Harry Potter, where in an act of removing ourselves from the creator, from the void, we've created like entire fandoms where, like, I'm not sure how much of the internet you're in or what parts of the internet you're in, but like the Marauders, we don't have actually any content from the like any canon, I should say, quote unquote canon content from the Marauders, but there are four actors who have been like just almost decided by the fans as being the like the young Marauders, like Harry's dad and his friends. And I think it's that like the without the void, the creator engaging in the thing, we've taken ownership. That's what I like to think. I recognize that that's not like a generally accept, or I shouldn't say generally. I recognize that that's not like universally accepted view of Harry Potter. I don't think you should always separate the art from the artist. But also with something of this size and magnitude, when you genuinely can't tell the difference between like canon and headcanon, it's blown up beyond somebody's ability to like claim ownership over that community.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that in terms of like literary critical perspectives too, we're far beyond, at least in academia, believing, for instance, that the author is the sole authority with regard to, I guess, like the meaning of their text or the significance of their text.
Yeah.
There's tons of different ways that you could choose to respond to this. I fancy myself something of a post-structuralist literary critic. Saussurean linguistics and Derrida, but of course there's also reader response theory. I mean, there's tons of ways to debunk or at least respond to kind of the common sense expressive realist idea of literature, which is to say that authors write stories that just reflect their perspectives, and they grant them to us as the readers. So I mean, I'm totally on board with the idea that there even is like a collaborative element to fandom, even if it
Yeah.
means that the stories take on lives that exceed the original intention of the author, and you can kind of leave the author behind, right? They're no longer necessary for kind of doing these things with stories. But I also there's a very interesting history. You would have to talk to more of a like an 18th centuryist than me to kind of
Oh,
know more about this.
like
Our
our
friend, our
mutual
mutual friend
friend.
Nina Cook would know more about this,
I
huh?
was going to say Taylin.
Yeah, well, Taylan might know this as well.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting when you go back and you look at certain authors from, and I always mess up the 18th and the 19th century. I apologize. I'm a bit of a modernist,
I was
but
going to say, I also have a degree in 18th century, so I don't know why I brought up other
sure.
people.
Like Dickens, for example, right?
Yes.
There are Dickens novels that are written, or were originally written as like periodicals. And so you would have these stories where basically Dickens would publish one chapter and it would show up in a newspaper, and people would read it, and then people would like write into the newspaper, and people would speculate, and there would be discourse amongst the public as to what is
Yeah.
happening in the story. And you know what happens is the authors like Dickens, they're reading the newspaper, they're seeing what people are thinking, and then the story is actually changing in response to public feedback regarding how people are feeling about the story. So there's a much longer historical precedent of communities actually having an
Yeah.
influence on how their favorite stories play out than people realize. It's not, Charles
Yeah.
Dickens just doesn't go into his bedroom, sit down and crank out, Great Expectations,
Yeah,
right?
no.
It's, so.
I mean, there's like the very like basic sense of like supply and demand, where if you're writing a book that people want to read, that's how you're going to sell it. If you don't want to write a book that people want to read, you can't sell it. I also want to bring up the fact that like we're currently having a resurgence in like fan fiction. And I will say that like the bookish community needs to be more conscious of how they're engaging with that, because when you bring money into the mix, because too many people are trying to like monetize this. It's like at that point you deal with copyright issues.
Right.
But like the oh God, I can't even remember what it's called. I think it's getting officially published under a new name, but it was like the Dramione fan fiction that was super big when it first came out, and it's currently having a resurgence. Dramione is Draco and Hermione. Sorry. And it's currently having a resurgence, and it just reminds me that like that resurgence is okay. Like the going back to like, you know, the unsaid rules that we explore when we're engaging with other fiction or fantasy or science fiction, you know, whatever, is the like, you know, if you want to ask the very literal question, which is like, why is fan fiction of this source okay, more okay than, you know, engaging with the source material? And it's not a difficult question to answer. It's the fact that it doesn't fund her. You know, her being Rowling.
Fan fiction is also a very interesting example as far as like communal engagement with a
Yes.
particular story. One of my favorite examples to give, because I know certain people hate this novel, but like White Sargasso Sea with response to like Jane Eyre. You know, there's a very interesting way in which White Sargasso Sea you could argue is just kind of a fan fiction. But it's a fan fiction that I would argue is legitimate. Not that there is, you know, like I'm not going to try and argue between legitimate versus illegitimate, but there's a subtext in Jane Eyre, which is like, well, you know, how did Rochester get ridiculously wealthy? Why is there a woman in his attic? You know, like there are these questions that, based on the perspective that you get in Jane Eyre, don't necessarily receive satisfying answers. And so there's a real way in which White Sargasso Sea is kind of drawing out, in a way, what is already there, subtextually in Jane Eyre, and asks you to consider, well, does your perspective on this story change if you know that Rochester is, you know, a misogynistic slaver, you know, who took a wife from the Caribbean and then put her in his attic, or put him, yeah. And so I think that, you know, a lot of people have this conception of fan fiction that it is just like self-indulgent fantasizing based on what readers want to be true and not necessarily something that accurately reflects the nature of a text. Though, in many cases, I would say fan fiction is often a reader's response to what they see as being in the text but not fully explored. You know, if people write Draco and Hermione fan fictions, or if they write, you know, like Katara and Zuko fan
Shut
fictions,
up.
it's because these are readers or viewers who genuinely see something of a romantic spark between these characters, you know, through interactions or through perhaps particular comments or the way that they're portrayed on screen by certain actors. And it's like, even if J.K. Rowling didn't intend for that to be the case, people see it in the text. And so the fan fiction is kind of a way of saying, well, allow me to explore this maybe a little bit more. Now, of course, sometimes you run into the case where a fan fiction, you know, goes into territory that becomes mutually exclusive with, I guess, the original text. And so at that point, right, well, you know, it's certainly not in the author's original intention. So I don't know, you know, the canon's a whole thing. I mean, you know, these books are fiction at the end of the day, right? It's like there's no real Hermione, right? It's like, but
It
anyway.
is some person's like perception of Hermione.
Right.
You've got, I mean, one of the most notable versions of fan fiction, and then we'll wrap things up here in a second. But with 50 Shades of Grey, which was Twilight
Right.
fan fiction, and that's just like you read it and it's like okay, but then you read it and you find out that it's Twilight fan fiction, and suddenly everything starts to make sense. All of the like the weird interactions make sense because technically when it was originally written, it was written within the context of this like pre-existing thing. And so when you pull it out of that, there's certain things that just no longer make sense because it doesn't have its like source material. And so yeah, going into that, like it is an act of community creation. And so if you pull it out of its like the thing that brought it meaning, it's lost some of its, I don't want to say value, but it's lost some of its like essence, I guess. So yeah. I am looking to do an episode on fan fiction coming up here soon. So
That'd be very cool. I look forward to it.
well, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been a pleasure.
Yes.
I've enjoyed being on the podcast. Sorry if I've been a little distracted in the past few minutes. My downstairs neighbors are arguing again, so that's always fun.
I can't hear it, so you're good.
That's good. I was worried about that.
Yeah.
I will say, shameless plug here. I also do a podcast
You know,
with
yeah,
one of
go
my
for it. Tell
friends.
me.
It is a video game podcast. I believe our episodes are on Spotify. We're called The Instruction Booklet. If you are interested in various topics on video game history or hearing me wax a little bit academically about kind of my own perspective of video games as a medium, my co-host Jeremy and I do that show monthly. We haven't recorded an episode this month yet because I've been busy with my dissertation. But it is ongoing. We've been doing it for about a year at this point, and that's very cool. And
Nice.
at some point, we're going to have Melissa on as a guest
Yeah.
host, guest speaker, guest visitor,
Guess.
guest. I can
Guest.
just say guest.
Yeah.
So keep an eye out for that, because that'll be a cool episode.
Yeah, I'll tell you guys all when I'm going to be on there. I really appreciate this. And if I'm reading or if I'm listening through and I'm editing this and I'm realizing there's words that you should have defined that I didn't ask you to define, I will shoot you a message and those will go in the description. So,
Yeah, it happens sometimes.
yeah, I mean, you're in the thick of academia. I remember those days. So, yeah. Well, I hope you have a great rest of your night and happy reading, everyone.
Yep, thanks everyone.
Thank you for joining me for another episode of In Bed with Books, a bookish podcast for bookish babes. Make sure to like and subscribe so you can keep up with all of the latest updates. And if you have any suggestions for authors, books, or topics that you want to hear about on the podcast, then feel free to DM me on Instagram or shoot me an email. I'm wishing you a lovely rest of your day, and until next time, happy reading.